Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers, and from Edvest and You, a loan product of the NEEF Network, a local nonprofit agency providing college student loans and student loan refinancing options. Information online at nhstudentloans.org or by calling 1-855-887-5430.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. By now, you've heard the advice 1,000 times. To prevent the spread of coronavirus, wear a mask in public, stay 6 feet apart, wash your hands. Sounds simple enough, but the longer we go on with this pandemic, the more we're learning it's complicated. For example, is 6 feet really the gold standard? Some research says 10 feet is far better. Also, while a mask helps prevent you from spreading virus, if it's hanging off your nose, it's not very effective. And then there's hand washing and disinfecting, both widely stressed, but many experts say you don't need to wipe down your groceries. Today in The Exchange, the science behind the safeguards. Exchange listeners, what questions do you have about how these measures were established and why the advice sometimes changes? Our email is exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org. Our phone number is 1-800-892-6477. Our guests are Michelle Faye Cortez, senior medical reporter for Bloomberg News. Also, Eleanor Murray, assistant professor of epidemiology at the Boston University School of Public Health. And also Gregory Tsongalas, director of the Laboratory for Clinical Genomics and Advanced Technology at Dartmouth Hitchcock and a professor of pathology and laboratory medicine. Welcome to all of you. And Michelle, I want to start with you. Of these three fundamental pieces of prevention advice that we have been given over and over and over again, which one do you think, Michelle, is the hardest for your average person to understand or to follow?
Oh, that's a really great question. So let's see. Our three things are hand
mask,
washing,
6 feet, and social. wash. Yeah.
Right. Well, I mean, I think that probably everyone would understand that keeping your distance from somebody else is by far the easiest thing to understand, right? If you're not present with somebody, whether they're infected or not, you're not going to be able to pick up a virus. So that seems perhaps the 6 feet question, other like WHO says only 3 feet. So they're all over the map with that one. But, you know, I think people understand the general point, maybe not the 6 feet number. The hand washing is maybe the most controversial one within the community. There's some back and forth about how much risk there is from surfaces and how long the virus stays on surfaces. So I guess that's what I would pick. It's easy to wash your hands, but maybe people don't understand it quite as much.
Well, and Gregory, what do you think? What do you think is the hardest thing for people to grasp with these fundamental pieces of advice, or the hardest to grasp or hardest to follow?
I think, you know, hand washing is probably one of them. But I think out of the three, maybe the masking or the universal masking in trying to protect people via face masks.
Why is that, Gregory?
Well, I think it's inconvenient, first of all, and I think people don't understand the transmission of particles and viruses as well as we probably should when we're looking at the types of masks we're wearing and the extent to we're wearing them.
Do you think, Greg, that, you know, we've been told so many times the mask doesn't protect you from other people's virus, it prevents you from spreading virus to other people? Do you think people still get that, or do they put on a mask and go, okay, now I'm good?
Unfortunately, I think it's the latter. I think they put on the mask and now they think that everything is going to be fine, not recognizing that the type of mask that they're using, the way it's positioned on their face, how they manipulate the mask has a lot to do with the transmission of the virus or the potential transmission. And then the protection from other people that are wearing masks. Although it's there, we don't fully understand how well that works.
Wow. Well, and we'll definitely talk later about how to wear these things, which masks are the best. Again, if the mask is kind of baggy off your face, it's not maybe doing you very much good. But Eleanor, to you too, which of these three standard pieces of prevention advice do you see the most public confusion about?
Yeah, so I think definitely the masks is the hardest one for the public to understand. And I think that this is somewhat of a failing of the you know, official dissemination of this information, when we started telling people to wash their hands, you know, the WHO put out this video. There was a whole TikTok challenge about how to wash your hands properly. All of these things sort of explaining to people how to really get good, clean hands to make sure that you didn't have virus on them. And then suddenly there was this advice to wear masks where they were, it was just sort of find a mask somewhere and put it on. And there's so much uncertainty in the science in terms of, you know, what actually makes a good mask. How do you wear it to protect both yourself and other people? And I think that partly that uncertainty kind of led to not putting out good guidance, but it's not actually really that simple to wear a mask. We see a lot of people wearing them incorrectly. Their masks are too loose, or their masks don't cover enough of their face, or, you know, I have this, the few months ago, I saw somebody wearing a mask who pulled the mask down in order to cough into his hand and then put the mask back up.
Oh my goodness.
Which shocked me, but then I thought, you know, we never actually told people how to wear masks. So he doesn't necessarily know that that's not what the point of the mask is. And so I think that that's for me the biggest thing, that masks are not necessarily intuitive in how they work and how they need to be worn. And we have a lot of unanswered questions. We haven't been explaining them well to people.
Well, sure. And there's a lot of variation among the types of masks. And Michelle, I want to ask you about something that Eleanor just said, because I know you've been covering it. How have you seen the two main agencies that people rely on for guidance, the CDC here in the U.S. and then the World Health Organization, how have you seen them, Michelle, manage their responsibilities to inform the public?
Right. Well, that has been a moving target all along. Certainly part of that is because the virus itself is brand new and we didn't know how it was going to react in the world, if it was going to continue and take hold and spread, or if it would dissipate the way that SARS and MERS did, the two previous coronaviruses that we saw. So there was a lot of moving targets early on. Of course, virus is a virus, so you can estimate what's going to happen. But certainly, I think that there was a lot of uncertainty. Masking is a great example of that. Early on, we were actually told that we shouldn't be wearing masks. We were aggressively told to not wear masks in January and early February. We're told that we need to save those for hospitals, and if you have masks, to send them to the hospital. And then just as Eleanor said, it seemed like a little bit out of the blue, all of a sudden we got this mandate of, you know, now we are recommending masks and some places are actually mandating masks. And where do you even get them? You know, in some parts of the country, you couldn't get masks. 3M was cranking up production of the N95s and other things, but it was very difficult. And we have seen it changing over time with masking. Now, CDC and WHO both recommend that everybody should be wearing masks, not only if you have symptoms, but even if you don't have symptoms. So it has been a changing process right from the very beginning. And some of that is because we're learning more about the science, we're learning more about the virus. And sadly, some of it is about politics and making sure that the right messages are getting out there, and they're getting out there the right way by the right organizations. If we're embracing everyone moving in the same direction, sometimes there's some political impetus behind all of that.
Well, and I'll ask our scientists, Michelle, about the scientific part, but to what you said about the politics, I've got a headline here from the Washington Post's health reporter, Paige Winfield Cunningham, who just this morning put out a story. WHO, World Health Organization, has stumbled repeatedly, she says, in communicating about the coronavirus. Consider these inaccurate statements, Paige writes. The novel coronavirus isn't spread from human to human. People infected with it don't get protective antibodies. Asymptomatic people largely don't spread it. And she writes, what do these assertions have in common? They're all things the World Health Organization has suggested, but later walked back. They have caused mass confusion and criticism over how the organization is informing the public about the infectious and deadly virus. What do you think, Michelle? I mean, to some extent, you're right. This virus is new and nobody knew how it was going to act. But to some extent, the WHO has kind of been all over the map with this. Maybe they could have done a better job.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that they could have done a better job, and they should have done a better job, WHO and CDC. That being said, it has been a moving target. And also some of what you're seeing there is the challenges of reporting, because some of those things were true. Like, for example, you know, we're not seeing human to human spread in the very early days. If that, you know, in the, if you take that statement out of context, that could have been in the United States, we weren't seeing human to human spread. They were looking for that pretty aggressively from people who came to the United States from Asia, from Wuhan, and we didn't see it early on. Now, we know that a respiratory infection is going to spread from human to human if you put humans together, but we didn't see that early on in the United States. So if that's what that sentence referred to, then in that moment, it was true. But perhaps just a couple of days later, that was no longer true. And in fact, at that moment, it might not have been true. We just weren't aware that it was spreading from human to human. The other things are still unopened questions. Really, we're having an issue right now about asymptomatic spread. How big is the threat of asymptomatic spread? Of course, we know that that is probably happening. But when they actually go to try to pinpoint it and to see the science, to see how many people an asymptomatic patient infects, I mean, just think of how complicated that is. If you're asymptomatic, by definition, you have no symptoms. So first, we've got to find you. Then we've got to track everybody that you've been around. Then we've got to test and see if they've picked it up. Did they pick it up from you or from someone else? These are difficult scientific questions. So it's a large ask for the WHO and the CDC.
Wow. What do you guys think, Greg and Eleanor? How about you first, Eleanor? I won't ask you to get into some of the politics of this because that's not your job, but it has been tricky for even the most experienced scientists to fully understand this virus. What do you think, Eleanor? How has this affected researchers' ability to transmit clear information to the public when things do keep changing?
Yeah, I think that that's been a really big challenge of this pandemic is that I think, you know, even researchers that have some experience with science communication, they're usually that experience is about communicating things that are sort of well-established, clearly known facts. And right now we have this opposite that we're both scrambling to kind of learn about the virus and trying to in real time communicate both things that we're discovering and the uncertainty around those discoveries to the general public. And I think that this is really challenging. I think, you know, a lot of times some of the confusion that we're seeing with messages from the WHO or the CDC is when they report on sort of the absence of findings or what we sometimes call no findings, where they may say something like there's no human to human transmission. And what they mean is we have not yet detected it or it's not yet happening. And I think, you know, when epidemiologists heard that from the WHO, we thought, okay, so this hasn't happened yet. But when the general public saw it, they thought, oh, this can't happen. And I think similar with things like this idea that there's minimal asymptomatic transmission, my understanding is that really what the WHO was saying with that earlier this week is that there is minimal evidence of asymptomatic transition being picked up in the contact tracing. But as Michelle said, it's really hard to find people who are asymptomatically infected because they don't have symptoms. And so it's not really that surprising that we're not picking them up in the contact tracing, because contact tracing requires, you know, calling people up, asking them, did you have any symptoms? And if you didn't have symptoms, then it's going to be really hard to tell if you were infected or not.
And if you're asymptomatic, Eleanor, you may have a hard time getting a test.
Yes.
You know, I have tried this myself, hoping, you know, just wanted to get my family tested to see if we are part of this asymptomatic group. And we were told by the doctor that we can't give you a prescription for a test if you don't have symptoms. So I'm not sure how researchers are going to get the data about asymptomatic people when they're not giving people prescriptions to get tested if you're asymptomatic. You have to have symptoms first. It's kind of a catch-22 there. Greg, what do you think? This has been tough for the scientific community. You know, it's evolving. Our understanding grows every day. How does that impact your ability to present clear information to the public?
Well, it becomes really difficult. And I think, you know, hindsight's always 20/20. But if you look at the way this was approached, I think we're going to understand when things settle down that there were certainly mistakes made, delays that occurred and stuff. But it's difficult because when we say, or when the scientific and medical community says that this is novel, that means we've not seen anything like this before. And I think the genetics of the virus were the only thing we really understood because it matched up to this family of coronaviruses that we've had some experience with. And so all of these different guidelines, the changing of the recommendations that are coming about are just because we're learning things at a pretty rapid pace and we have to change and adjust to that. I'll just give you an analogy to what I think this was like, right? If you think about the first-time parent that has a newborn baby, right? They're trying to figure out what to do with this baby and how to take care of it and everything. You get some recommendations from your mother-in-law. Your mother says something different. Your friends tell you to do something completely different. And so you as the parent have to kind of take all of that information and come up with the best approach that you can to do this. And I think that's what we're seeing with the virus in this pandemic is that it's very, very different than what we thought, even though it's genetically similar to other viruses. It behaves very differently. And we're getting recommendations from a lot of different groups and scientific community and the medical community that sometimes contradict each other. So we have to kind of take the best of the best and put that into these recommendations to try and keep everybody as safe as possible.
Greg, what is the impact of the contradictions that you just mentioned and the evolving science? Again, I'm not blaming scientists. Again, this is completely new. And as you said, it's not behaving like past viruses. But I wonder about the impact of that confusion, of that contradiction, Greg. Will it get to the point where some people say, well, these scientists are all contradicting each other, so forget it. I'm not even going to, you know, bother.
No, I think we've seen that already, and I think it leads to frustration just because people don't understand how quickly the information is being generated and how quickly it changes. I'm not talking day to day. I'm talking even hour to hour with new information that's coming out from different groups that are doing the research on this virus now, whether they're epidemiologists or biologists and so on. So I think the biggest impact it has in really creating a lot of frustration, like you mentioned, of people just throwing their hands up in the air and saying, you know, nobody knows what's going on. I'm not going to do anything, which is probably a big mistake.
A couple last questions for you, Michelle, because I know you have to go. You are watching whether the nation will see a spike in infections from the racial justice demonstrations recently as people gathered in very large groups. Now, many of the photos I've seen, most people seem to be wearing masks, but social distancing, people are in many instances sitting close together, listening to speeches and so forth. Michelle, what are some of the concerns you're hearing from health officials? And what are the challenges going to be in tracking whether these large gatherings will cause outbreaks?
Yeah, I am based in Minneapolis, and so, of course, there have been quite a number of protests here and activity going on. It's a real concern for all the public health officials. As soon as they saw all of these people gathering in such close quarters, the possibility that the virus is there being seeded throughout these entire groups is real. Not only that, a lot of the people who are at the protests are minorities and people of color, groups that we already know are particularly hard hit by the coronavirus. So they might not have as much support. So it is kind of a recipe for disaster. The good news is, exactly as you said, that people are wearing masks. By and large, what I've seen, almost everyone is wearing masks, certainly during the day, even in the evenings, and it's outside. So we've seen study after study that does show that the virus is less efficiently passed when people are outside and when they're wearing masks. So that is hopeful that it'll be under control. The officials are concerned about it. They're saying some things that are just not going to happen. For example, that you should, if you've been to a protest, you should quarantine yourself. Almost by definition, those things are in odds with each other, right? If you're out there protesting, it's because you have something to say, so you're not going to go back to your house for 2 weeks. But there are other things that are maybe more hopeful, like if you do have vulnerable family members or people that you're living with, stay away from them. Now, if you're out protesting during the day or at night, now is not the time to go visit your grandmother on the weekend. Also, some public health officials are telling people that they should be tested, even if you are asymptomatic. And as you were saying, it can be difficult to get tests. But if you do some research, there are places where you can go get drive-in testing. As more and more testing is coming online, that should be more widely available. Knock on wood that that's going to happen. So the problem is we can't set up tents at the protests. necessarily to look for people, and you can't do contact tracing with these people. It's not, you can't say, well, I was at the protest, I was wearing a green shirt, I'm positive, so if you were next to me, you should also be aware. Everybody needs to be aware, because the risk is there for anyone who's been at the protest.
Well, from what I understand, Michelle, it'll be, you know, a number of days before we find this out, because it takes some time for the virus to show up. But I've also read, Michelle, and I want to ask you about this, some data that we're getting from gatherings over the Memorial Day long weekend. States were starting to open up. People were gathering, you know, in swimming pools and beaches and cookouts. What do we know now about Memorial Day weekend and the possible impact of those gatherings?
Yeah, we are seeing increasing numbers of cases in a number of states. We're also seeing a lot of that in southern states. So the idea that just warmer weather itself is going to be protective, that seems to be not the case with this virus, that everyone is vulnerable to it. We don't have any natural immunity, so people, it is spreading. We saw early on Mardi Gras actually caused an outbreak of cases. That was early days. We didn't have a lot of virus in the population at that point, and yet it did seed outbreaks, not only in New Orleans, but people who came to New Orleans, they brought it back to their hometowns. And we're seeing that again with Memorial Day. People were out there. They were having parties. And then you see that confluence of just people getting out with their families, having barbecues, going to the beach, picnicking, and then protests. So we're probably never going to be able to break these two things apart and figure out exactly the numbers that we say, although epidemiologists might be able to do that, because they do crack down in these numbers pretty specifically. But it's going to be a huge challenge. And for sure, it'll be interesting to see what happens when we look at the numbers going forward, because this is not something that, you know, it's not a fixed thing. One person passes it to someone else, and then they pass it to more people and more people. So if we start seeing the increasing rates, it could happen exponentially.
Well, Michelle, it's good to have you with us. We know you need to go, but we really appreciate your time this morning.
Absolutely.
That's Michelle Faye Cortez, senior medical reporter for Bloomberg News. Now, coming up after a short break, we will get into some of the specifics that our guests hinted at, the details about masks, that ubiquitous 6 feet apart. Also, I'll ask our guests why we are often advised to gather in groups of 10 or less. Why not 8 or fewer? Why not 12 or fewer? And does it matter who those 10 people are? All that's coming up, plus your calls at 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-6477. Stay with us. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Back to our conversation about the science behind the safeguards and why some of the advice around coronavirus keeps evolving as our understanding evolves. Exchange listeners, it's your chance to get those questions that have been bothering you into our conversation. What do you want to know about masks? What do you want to know about what you need to disinfect and what you don't? And what do you think about that 6 feet apart? Should that be the gold standard? Should it be more? Should it be less? Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Our email, exchange@nhpr.org. Use Facebook, tweet us, or again, call in 1-800-892-6477. Joining us for the rest of the hour, Eleanor Murray, Assistant Professor of Epidemiology at the Boston University School of Public Health. Also, Gregory Tsongalas, Director of the Laboratory for Clinical Genomics and Advanced Technology at Dartmouth Hitchcock, and a Professor of Pathology and Laboratory Medicine. And the questions are starting to come in from listeners, and I'd love to go to some of them now, both of you. Daryl in Manchester writes, I'm planning to attend a convention in July in Orlando. The organizers have indicated that attendees will be socially distanced and seated 6 feet apart. The hotel will require temperature checks before entering the hotel, and wearing masks will be, quote, encouraged. Daryl says, I'm curious if this will be enough to keep the attendees safe from anyone who might attend and be asymptomatic. Daryl, it is a great question. I'm sure lots of people have similar questions. And I'll turn to you first, Greg, please.
Yeah, sure. Thanks for the question. I think, you know, the recommendation of wearing a mask is not enough. I think it needs to be mandatory, especially in settings like that. The social distancing and physical distancing, I think we'll talk about a little bit later, but that 6 foot distance may or may not be enough to protect individuals. And, you know, so I get really wary about larger gatherings, even with some of these things in place.
So you need both, it sounds like, Greg. You need the mask and the social distancing. One on its own is not enough.
Correct. And I think, you know, one of the things we haven't talked about a lot during this pandemic is that there's some evidence that the virus infects individuals through mucous membranes. And so you immediately think, well, that's your mouth and your nose, and
sure,
it's a respiratory thing. But that also includes your eyes. And I don't know how strong the data is and if there is a lot of data to support that with this particular virus, but that's another big concern.
You know, I did see something like that recently, wear a mask and glasses. And I thought, oh my gosh. So do you want to jump in on Daryl's question as well, Eleanor? I think it's interesting that this convention is even going on. I'm surprised it's not canceled, but go ahead, Eleanor. He's concerned that it might not be enough to keep attendees safe.
Yeah, so I think it does seem surprising to me that a convention like this would be happening. I'm also a little bit concerned that it's in Orlando, because we're seeing rumors that other types of events and spaces will open up in Orlando as well. So I think not even just thinking about the convention itself, but also what's going on in the city where the convention is located is important for thinking about safety. I definitely agree with Greg's comments. I would say that from my understanding, there is evidence that it can spread through eyes. And there, the issue is sort of more if you rub your eyes, you may rub virus into your mucous membranes. I know that even in Wuhan, we were seeing early on reports of conjunctivitis as an early symptom. And so that is something to be concerned about, and especially in something like a crowded convention center where there may be elevator buttons and things like this that a lot of people are touching. If you get virus on your hands and then you rub your eyes, that could be a transmission route.
Wow.
The other thing I wanted to just quickly touch on is this idea of temperature checks. So first of all, I think we're seeing something only like 40% of symptomatic patients have a fever when they go to their doctor. And so that doesn't even necessarily seem like a great way of picking up symptomatic patients, but asymptomatic or pre-symptomatic individuals are not going to have a fever. That's kind of by definition. And so temperature checks really, in a lot of ways, those are kind of a type of sort of security theater. I'm not particularly fond of them, because in order to check someone's temperature, you have to get quite close to them. And so, you know, it's a situation where you're potentially, the person who's checking the temperature is potentially now exposed within 6 feet of all of the individuals that are getting checked. And it's not even necessarily picking up, you know, certainly those people who do have temperatures, that's a useful way to pick them up. But there's potentially many more people who are infectious that don't have a temperature that won't be picked up in that way.
Wow, that's really interesting, Eleanor. And so, Greg, I have to ask you about that as well. I mean, I myself have had a number of these temperature checks recently, going to various places, doctor's appointments, and so forth. What do you think about what Eleanor says? Temperature checks are security theater. I myself have wondered about these, given what we know now about asymptomatic people or people who present symptoms differently, not a fever. What do you think, Greg?
Yeah, sure. You know, I agree that you don't always have that fever, but it's one of those measures or metrics that we can easily obtain on people. And so to use it as a screen is going to be something that we can easily do. And it'll be effective in identifying some people, but it's not going to identify everybody, right? I think when it comes to the symptoms of this virus and most viruses, they're so vague and so broad as far as what the actual symptoms are, that it could be almost anything that justifies somebody coming in now for a test. You know, you think about the season we're in now, it's allergy season. And so do people that have a runny nose or a headache have coronavirus, or is it just their allergies acting up? So I think there are all types of things like this on the clinical side that we have to be able to monitor. And the temperature check is just a simple, quick check to identify somebody that may be symptomatic or may start to be symptomatic, but it's not going to be, you know, a guarantee.
All right, let's take a call. Thank you for writing in, by the way, that emailer. And Deb is calling from Royalston, Massachusetts. Hi, Deb. Go ahead. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi, Laura. I have enjoyed your show for years. So there was an article in the Keene Sentinel last week, and it said, why would Keene need a face mask ordinance? And the person contended that Keene didn't need it, and the person proposing it, who is one of the Keene City councilors, was doing it for personal political gain. And then he goes on to say, well, he, in fact, this guy who wrote the letter, does wear a mask. And anyway, I had written the response to the Sentinel, but they didn't publish it. And since then, also, that proposal by that Keene City councilor has been withdrawn. But anyway, I am the reason that masks need to be worn. Not only am I dealing with a very rare pneumonia, I have recently had lung surgery. And I am home on my 25-acre farm in Royalston, and I can't go anywhere for literally 2 months. And when I can drive again and go places, I will come to Keene, where I work, I shop, I eat, I play. I love it. And so wearing a mask for me is a no-brainer, and I hope it is for everybody else.
So, Deb, how do you feel then? I mean, as we heard earlier, you wearing a mask protects other people from you. It doesn't protect you from other people. So that's kind of a conundrum for you, isn't it?
Yeah, but if they're wearing masks, it should be protecting, giving me some sense of, protection if they are wearing masks too. So,
right.
It works. It's a no-brainer for me, for everybody to be wearing masks.
Well, thank you very much for calling in, Deb. And, you know, I wanted to ask both our guests, when it comes to reopening the economy, there does seem to be a patchwork of approaches throughout the country on wearing masks. Some states mandate these. In other states like New Hampshire, they're strongly recommended but not mandated. That said, the city of Nashua has mandated them. Eleanor, you first. What are your thoughts, again, as a scientist who studies these diseases, on these inconsistencies?
So I think, we talk a lot about the inconsistencies in masks, but really all of our response has been patchwork. You know, even when we were sort of talking about, lots of the country is under lockdown, what that meant varied from location to location. So I don't think it's necessarily anything particular about masks that's patchwork. But I do think that it's challenging with masks to know what is the best recommendation to give. And this is because, you know, we really haven't had a situation where we had a respiratory virus of this severity before. And so we don't have really that great scientific evidence on what are all of the features that you should be looking for in a mask, how often should you be wearing it, things like how should you be sterilizing disposable masks if you don't have enough to wear a new one every time that you put one on. There are a lot of really unanswered questions from a scientific perspective about masks. And so I think, you know, in general, there's sort of this sense, well, a mask is a barrier between you and the rest of the world, and so it will probably catch at least some of your droplets, and it's a good thing to wear it. But how to wear that safely and what that means, I think, is still something that we really need to figure out better scientifically.
Well, thank you for calling, Deborah, and good luck to you. She's got some challenges to deal with there. Peter's calling from Mason. Hi, Peter. You're on the air. Welcome to the Exchange. Go ahead.
Well, thank you. It's an honor to be on the show. Maybe I should turn my phone down here. My question has to do with masks, and I'm pretty good about wearing my masks. Very good, I would say, in public. But I have a variety. I have a K95, N95, and I have the more inexpensive. In New Hampshire, they're pretty available. And I've been rotating them, meaning especially the N95s, that I hang them up for a couple of days and then reuse them. The other ones, the cheaper ones, I do sometimes also rotate those and reuse those. So I'm really asking about that. And I don't even think that maybe N95 masks are all created equal either, even though they're more readily available. So, and they're more expensive, obviously. So I hope that's a clear enough kind of question to dive into.
So, Peter, rotating masks, but also do you wash them, Peter?
No, not the I have many cloth masks, and that's kind of another whole thing. These are the kind of the paper ones. So no, I just hang them up because I heard that the virus only can last 2 or 3 days on a
sure.
So especially N95 ones. I have three or four of them, and I, you know, I hang them up and I rotate them.
Okay. Well, lots of specific questions about masks that I'm sure lots of other listeners have as well. So thank you for calling, Peter. And Greg, I'm going to throw that to you, sort of the care of masks and how to do it properly.
No, I think that's a great question. I think you have a great system in place. You know, the N95 masks are the ones that are recommended, especially for healthcare providers when they're dealing directly with patients that have the infection. And rotating them that way is really a pretty good idea for you, because you're probably not as exposed to individuals that may be symptomatic as we are at the facilities that are treating these people. So I think that's not a bad idea. I think, you know, one of the things that we have to be a little bit concerned about is how long the virus actually stays alive on different surfaces. And those numbers, like everything else, seem to be changing all the time. But rotating them around, I think, is not a bad idea at all. You know, you have to think about when you're wearing these masks, even if you're just breathing normally and whatnot, the inside of them gets wet from your breath, right, from the aerosol or the droplets in your breath. And when that happens, you kind of lose the effectiveness of the mask, because wet material kind of allows things to penetrate more so than if it were dry and intact, so to speak. So I think what you're doing is probably the best that we're going to be able to get at right now.
So just let it stay hung up, but don't wash it, Greg?
You can't really wash the paper disposable mask that you see surgeons wear most of the time. And then the N95 masks that we use at the facility here are treated with specific chemicals and not really washed. So I'm not sure that if you have those types of masks, that's a good idea to even try, because you may lose the effectiveness of them. If you have a cloth mask that you've made and that you supplement it with a dryer sheet or something else, then certainly you can wash those. But the others, the more medical masks, are not really made to be washed.
I see. So hang them up. Don't wash them, or just use them once and throw them out?
Well, if you could use the more paper disposable ones and you have enough to use them and throw them out, that's great. If you don't, letting them hang and dry, I think, is probably the next best thing.
Okay. Well, you just saved me some trouble, because I've been washing mine. So thank you for that. And also thank you for that call, Pete. And we really appreciate your comment. Our phone number is 1-800-892-6477. And our email, exchange@nhpr.org. Tons of questions about masks from our listeners. So I want to just throw one more at you from Frank in Bedford, because I think he asks some questions that a lot of people have. Frank says, I have been doing all our shopping since mid-March, going out once every 2 weeks. I do wear a mask and gloves every single time. When I return home, Frank says, I do the following. All clothes in the washer, take a shower for the second time that day, and also wash my hair again. Wash down all the groceries with bleach water, and leave the grocery bags in the garage for 48 hours. Frank says, please help with correct information. Are all these four steps necessary? Wow, Frank, I think there's probably a lot of listeners who are taking some of those steps, if not all of them. And Eleanor, could we go through those, please? You know, throwing his clothes in the wash and taking a shower. I mean, is that helpful?
So I think there's a distinction here maybe between helpful and necessary. So I think, you know, for some people, that's going to be a really useful step, because they really have, you know, a high risk level where they really cannot afford to get coronavirus. Certainly putting your clothes immediately in the wash, taking a shower, washing your hair, that will ensure that if there was any virus on you from outside, that you're not bringing it into the house. And so I think it can be helpful. It may be more than is necessary. You know, personally, when I go to the grocery store, when I come home, I change my clothes, but I wouldn't necessarily do like a full decontamination shower, depending on how close I've been to people.
And here's the other second half of his email, which again, I think, Greg, a lot of listeners will have this question. Wash down all the groceries with bleach water and leave the grocery bags in the garage for 48 hours. This gets to the surface contamination question, Greg, that a lot of people have. So if you could take that one, please.
So, yeah, I'm not sure if what the actual recommendation is for, you know, surface contact of the virus with vegetables and things like that that you might come out of the grocery store with, but washing down your vegetables in a normal time is not a bad idea, never mind during a pandemic. I'm not sure that leaving everything in the garage for 48 hours is really necessary, but I think you have to ask yourself how cautious you want to be and what risk you're willing to take. I think this sounds like really way overkill, but you know, the first time something happens and goes wrong, we'll all say, "Oh my gosh, we should have washed our vegetables."
Yeah.
It's just one of those unknowns where, you know, if it makes you comfortable and makes you safe or feel safe, then you should do it. But if it's, you know, something that has really no evidence to support it, then we probably shouldn't. Right. Unfortunately, this is one of those areas where there isn't a lot of evidence or data to support any of that.
I'm wondering, Greg, you know, vegetables, we should probably, like you said, wash them no matter what kind of time we're living in. But do you, Greg, like wipe down your cereal boxes or your milk cartons?
I don't know.
Yeah. And this gets to what we talked about earlier, because a couple friends, I do have a few friends, not most of my friends, but a few friends who are doing this. And I said to one of them the other day, you know, you don't have to do that, that the state's, you know, top epidemiologists have said you don't have to do that. And she said, and this gets to the confusion and the cynicism, I think, Greg, she said, well, they say that today, but who knows what they'll say tomorrow? The advice around this thing is always changing. I live with an immunocompromised mother, she said, and I'm wiping down my cereal boxes. And I wonder what you think about that, Greg.
No, I think that's a very valid concern, but it gets us to one of the other points that you made earlier in the program about hand washing that really helps alleviate a lot of this, right? That if you're routinely washing your hands and washing them well, then it doesn't matter what you really come in contact with, right? As long as you're washing your hands. Stuff. And so I think a lot of the concerns that people have about this contact with the potential virus on a surface goes away if people wash their hands routinely. And routinely is more than, a lot more actually than what you would normally do.
I see. So maybe in the remote possibility that there's a tiny bit of virus on your cornflakes, just if you're washing your hands, you're not going to get infected by that. And also, again, from what I understand, Greg, correct me if I'm wrong, virus on these surfaces don't last forever. They don't last that long. Is that correct?
Correct.
Okay.
Correct. And the timing varies depending on the type of surface, apparently.
We will talk a lot more after a short break. And Frank, thank you so much for that email, because I'm guessing a lot of people had similar questions. Your emails are welcome at exchange@nhpr.org. And our phone number is 1-800-892-6477. More in a moment. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Social distancing, masks, hand hygiene. Today we're looking at the science behind these safeguards. As much as researchers have learned about COVID-19, so many questions remain about prevention, from that 6 feet apart rule to the most effective ways to wear a mask. We are finding out more this hour, and we've been hearing a lot from you, so keep those questions coming in. Our email, exchange@nhpr.org. You can comment on Facebook, or you can give us a call, 1-800 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-6477. We're talking this hour with Eleanor Murray, Assistant Professor of Epidemiology at the Boston University School of Public Health, and also Gregory Tsongalas, Director of the Laboratory for Clinical Genomics and Advanced Technology at Dartmouth Hitchcock, and a Professor of Pathology and Laboratory Medicine at Dartmouth. I want to ask both of you about what we're seeing now with summer and people getting out and, you know, states opening up their economies. And every week there's sort of a new list of places that we can go. As these places open up, many are stressing their hygiene practices, how much they're disinfecting everything. And some are requiring masks. I went to Trader Joe's, for example, over the weekend, and you had to wear a mask to go there. What do you think, Eleanor? Do these organizations, are they overemphasizing these precautions that they're taking, making people feel like things are safer than they really are? Or do these precautions, wiping down everything 100 times a day, making everybody wear masks, trying to keep people apart at the grocery store, can those help us get out and do things safely?
Yeah, so I think it's definitely important to think about sort of the spectrum of risk. It's not, you know, somewhere is safe and somewhere else is unsafe. It is really about, you know, what precautions are places taking. And so, you know, when we see stores like, for example, Trader Joe's limiting the number of people who can come in and wiping things down and wearing masks, then that is going to make that store safer to shop at compared to if they weren't doing any of those things. Whether or not it's going to make it, you know, as safe as could possibly be, I think is, you know, somewhat an open question, but I think, you know, nothing is completely risk-free right now. So long as there are some cases in your area, there's always the potential that you'll come in contact with the virus from coming in contact with those individuals. But the idea is really just to try to make these activities as safe as we can. And I think some of that falls on the businesses, but some of that also falls on each of us to wear our masks, to not touch our faces, to wash our hands well, to keep our distance.
You know, Greg, what have we learned from earlier pandemics as we look at these prevention measures that are being, you know, recommended today? What have we learned from earlier viruses, maybe as far back as the Spanish flu, you tell me, that might still apply to our time now?
Well, I think, you know, the physical distancing, the 6-foot distance that people keep saying we should keep between each other and stuff is one of those things. And, you know, that is about the distance that we're able to measure droplets or aerosols coming out from an individual's mouth and whatnot. And so I think that distancing, whether it's 6 feet or 10 feet, has been critical. And I think in states that implemented those types of precautions quickly showed much more containment of the spread of the virus. Right. I just want to kind of give you another analogy, if that's okay, to
sure.
What this is like, because I think when people speak and you don't see anything coming out of your mouth, that doesn't mean that nothing's coming out of your mouth, right? And so we talk about two things, droplets and aerosols. So droplets are larger particles, you know, when you sneeze into a tissue or into your shirt sleeve and there's a little bit of wet material there, those are the larger droplets. And I equate that to having a handful of marbles. And if you throw those marbles up in the air in front of you, they typically settle down and fall straight down because of gravity and stuff. If you did the same thing with a handful of paper confetti, you'd throw that up in the air, and most of it would come relatively straight down, but you'd have some of it spread around where it was going to fall to the ground, right? Those are what I anticipate or equate to an aerosol and really tiny, tiny particles that come out of your mouth, not just when you sneeze, but also when you talk, right? And so if you think about that, those two scenarios, and then you add a little bit of a breeze to the conditions, right, those larger particles, a lot of them will still drop to the ground straight down, but they may spread just a little bit. The confetti with a little bit of breeze spreads a lot. And so as you're talking, as you're breathing, as you're sneezing, you're pushing these particles out around you to a certain distance. And it's been somewhere between 6 to 10 feet that people have been able to measure that distance of where these particles land. And then if you add in you know, all of the environmental conditions like the breeze and the wind and things like that, that distance becomes a lot greater, right? And so the best analogy or the best kind of equivalent type of thing to this that I've seen has been the analogy or the analogy to somebody that's smoking. So if you're outside and there's somebody smoking a cigarette and you can smell the cigarette smoke, then you would have been exposed to the virus if they were infected with the virus. That's how much these particles, because they're so small, can travel.
So the smaller droplets, are those the speaking droplets? Is that the confetti in your
analogy,
aerosol. Greg?
Yeah, okay. Correct. So those would be the aerosolized droplets that you don't really see as you're speaking that come out of your mouth.
So what does that say to you, Greg, about 6 feet? Is 10 feet better? I'm struck by your smoking analogy, too. I mean, you can usually smell a cigarette from, you know, more than 6 feet away.
Yeah, I think, you know, 6 feet with you know, universal masking will probably be sufficient. I think for people that don't believe that universal masking and these other precautions are necessary, that 6 foot distance may not be protective enough.
Oh, wow. Okay. Well, let's take another call. This is Mary in Nashua. Go ahead, Mary. You're on The Exchange. Welcome.
Yeah, thank you for taking my call. I do a lot of hiking, especially up in the mountains, and my dog is primarily off-leash. I am concerned about her meeting other dogs and meeting people. I can pretty much bring her in from the people, but I can't really control other people's dogs. Is she a surface carrier? I consider her a surface. So I'm concerned about another dog touching her, a person touching her, and then my being able to contact the virus when I touch my dog.
Wow, Mary, we had some veterinarians on last week or the week before, so they definitely would have had an answer to that question. I'm not sure if our guest today can answer that. Eleanor, is that even within your field of expertise?
So, I mean, I have seen people talking about the potential for dogs as a sort of shared surface, but I think, especially out in the woods, something to remember is that, you know, even if your dog rubs up against another dog and some virus transfers from the one dog's fur to the other dog's fur, probably, you know, your dog is then going to go and like sniff around in some plants. And, you know, so the chance, you know, by the end of the walk that your dog has any virus on its fur, I think would be pretty minimal because they're not sort of a perfect clean surface that's not coming in contact with other things. But I do think it's something we don't really know about, but I think, you know, sort of thinking about all of the things that would come in contact with the outside of the dog over the course of a hike, you would probably expect that any virus that got on the fur would at some point be rubbed back off the fur.
Well, and that does get to what both of you have said. That's why the hand washing is important. Even if Mary's dog did get something, some measure of virus, which seems unlikely, it would get off once she got home and washed her hands, or if she pulled out some hand sanitizer very quickly and, you know, put it on her hands. I'm glad you called, though, Mary, because this does get to something that you guys hinted at before, but I wanted to ask you, and Greg, I'll turn to you. Outside versus inside. Now, Michelle hinted at this when she was with us before, that outside is better than inside. Certainly people are gathering outside now. You know, it's not healthy for people to stay in forever. So what can you tell us, Greg, about outside versus inside?
Well, I think, you know, the natural instinct is that you're outside, you're in the fresh air, and what could possibly go wrong? And I think if you're hiking or if you're alone or in a small group that's physically distanced, then that's not a bad, that's okay. I would prefer to be outside than inside. I think if you're in some of these large gatherings that we've seen, not just for the protests, but for other gatherings that have been reported in the news, where there's just people shoulder to shoulder, whether you're outside or inside is not going to matter. I think that's a really bad idea. And the reason I say that is we know that not for the symptomatic patients, but for the asymptomatic people we keep talking about, those people, just because they're asymptomatic doesn't mean they don't have the infection, right? And you, by the time you get infected to the time you show symptoms is somewhere in the order of 2 to 3 days at least. So for several days, these people are shedding, well, what we call the silent shedders, a virus at very high levels to the environment around them. And so that's where my big concern comes, even if you're outside.
So given, and this keeps coming up and we're almost out of time, but given what you just said, Greg, should everyone, no matter how they feel, go get tested?
I'm not sure everyone should get tested. I think, you know, we're starting to do a lot of testing on what we would think of as asymptomatic patients before they have procedures done in the hospital. We're starting to test staff, things like that. But I'm not sure that universal testing just yet is warranted.
Okay. Well, and if you've got questions about who can get tested, where and how, we've got links on our website, nhpr.org/exchange, that covers that. And that is a topic for a whole nother show. For now, though, there's so much more that we could have talked about. I really appreciate both of you being with us this morning. It was really helpful. Professor Tsongalas, thank you very much for being with us.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
That's Gregory Tsongalas. He's director of the Laboratory for Clinical Genomics and Advanced Technology at Dartmouth and a professor of pathology and laboratory medicine. And Eleanor Murray, thank you also very much.
Thank you.
That's Professor Eleanor Murray. She's an assistant professor of epidemiology at the Boston University School of Public Health. Thanks for being with us. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoi.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.